of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. It is case number A182156. So council, take a few minutes and get organized, but when you're ready, we're ready to begin arguments. Announce your appearance as you will before your argument in chief, please.
May I begin, Your Honor?
Please.
May it please the court. Ali Afshar Javan, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Minnesota, representing the Commissioner of Human Services in this matter, who is the appellant. This case is about whether the law allows someone to retain an unlimited amount of real property, namely life estate interest, and still have Medicaid, which is the payer of last resort, pay for that spouse's long-term care services or his or her spouse's long-term care services.
Well, counsel, isn't it really the issue of statutory interpretation of what the words in the statute mean?
Ultimately, it is, Your Honor. This is a matter of law before the court to be decided de novo. That is a standard of review for this legal question. So there is a community spouse asset allowance, or the CSAA, and that represents the amount of certain assets that a community spouse may keep without affecting his institutionalized spouse's medical assistance, long-term care eligibility, or MALTC eligibility. The law provides that the CSAA has a cap. At the time of respondent's application, it was about $120,000. Also, life estate interests count towards that cap. Neither state nor federal law exclude life estate interests, non-homestead life estate interests from that cap. Minnesota statute section 256B.059, there's nothing in there that excludes life estate interest from this CSA cap or from counting towards the CSAA. So having established both of those things, it naturally would follow that the law would assign some sort of significance to a institutionalized spouse having assets that exceed the CSAA cap, and it does. The Minnesota law does provide that those assets that do exceed the CSAA cap are counted as assets for a MALTC applicant when they are applying for MALTC.
So just to be clear, counsel, are you talking about the life estate being included in for valuation of the estate?
Correct, Your Honor. It would be valued towards the CSAA, towards the community spouse asset allowance.
Okay, so and that's the first step of that.
That's the first step. We start at section 256B.059. That provision or that statutory section that specifically addresses the first step in the statutory analysis here. That is about the treatment of assets when one spouse is institutionalized. So,
counsel, I don't think there's any dispute as to whether the life estates are counted in the valuation. I think the dispute comes in terms of whether the life estates are counted in eligibility of the applicant, right?
Ultimately,
under 256B.056 subdivision 4A.
Ultimately, that appears to be the question before the court. So 256B.059 does have the analysis, does explain that anything that is part of the CSAA that goes beyond the CSAA cap is counted in 256B.056 as an asset available or deemed available to the applicant. So if we were to end with 256B.056 subdivision 4A and look at that statute in isolation, it would be a different case, but that's not what the law is. These statutes need to be read together, and we start at 256B.059 that specifically addresses how we need to treat assets when one spouse is institutionalized.
Right, but that section goes to the valuation. And then when you get to subdivision 4A, then you look at eligibility, including any exclusions, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. So
then looking at, let's look at subdivision 4A, because I think that's really the heart of the issue here. And when I read your brief and the materials, your brief, you mentioned the word individual on page 7, but you don't get to it again until page 17 of your brief, that word individual. And that's the key word, I think, here that is in dispute. When it says, for purposes of verification, an individual is not required to make a good faith effort to sell a life estate that is not excluded under subdivision 2. But your brief seems to substitute the word individual with the other words with respect to the institutionalized spouse.
Your Honor, I wouldn't call it a replacement. I would call it just analyzing what the statute means and what it says.
Well, but don't we start with the words in the statute?
We do start with the words in the statute, but
okay,
we don't.
Let's start with the word in the statute. It says an individual.
That's correct, Your Honor. It does say an individual.
An individual is very, very broad.
And,
right?
And Your Honor, the statute 256B.056, that is a statute that governs the treatment of assets for MA applicants. And the MA applicant here was not Mr. Schmalz, it was Ms. Schmalz.
And I understand that, but the language here says an individual. In the second sense, it talks about institutional spouses or community spouses. So aren't we to assume that if the legislature intended that word to refer to the institutional spouse or the MA applicant, that they would have used that word?
I don't think we should assume that, Your Honor, because...
Why not? Because we need to look at the plain language of the statute.
And
the plain language says an individual. Let me ask you this. What does the word an individual mean?
It means a person.
Okay.
I would say that would be a general definition of what it would mean.
But it's a general term.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct, but it's written in the context of a person applying for MA.
It sounds like you're reading words into the statute when you say that. When you say in an individual applying for, where is that language to modify the word individual here?
It's what the entire section is about, Your Honor, but no, it's not.
Where is it here, though?
Your Honor, the word applicant is plainly not in subdivision 4A. The word, the physical word applicant. However, that subdivision applies to all MA applicants. It's not something unique to MALTC applicant. Any MA applicant can invoke that provision. The second sentence of that does explain how it applies only for the purposes of determining eligibility for medical assistance and does not apply to the valuation of assets owned by either the institutionalized spouse or the community spouse under 256B.059 subdivision 2. That language would be entirely superfluous if the court were to adopt the respondent's interpretation of the law. There would be absolutely no reason to have that in there, and it would violate the canon against surplusage.
I don't follow that logic, because the way I read that, it says here you're looking at it only for the purposes of determining eligibility. The valuation has already been, that's step one. Now we're looking at step two in terms of eligibility, and this is how this applies at this step. How is that inconsistent? I don't see how that's inconsistent.
Because only one of the two spouses is applying for MA, not both of them, Your Honor.
But you're looking at the assets of both parties, right?
No, Your Honor. 256B.059 answers this question for us. It tells us how to treat the assets of both parties. And then when we go back, we end with 256B.056. Not just subdivision 4A, this person needs to become eligible for MA at that time, or they're trying to become eligible for MA. I think to just end at subdivision 4A would ignore an entire statute that deals precisely with this question, how we treat, or how the law treats assets of an MA applicant when one spouse is institutionalized.
But if the as in this case where the value of the life estates exceeds the CSAA, that additional value is attributable to the applicant, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So then we are looking at those life estates that are above the cap in evaluating her eligibility, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. As described by 256B.059, it's the value that exceeds the CSAA. In this case, I believe is about $160,000 worth of life estates and other assets. But that value would be added to whatever Ms. Schmalz or the MA applicant's assets are. And then it's clearly above. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Oh, go ahead.
It's above the limit. It's just the law is not designed, and it does not say that a community spouse can retain an unlimited amount of life estate interest and at the same time have his or her spouse become eligible for medical assistance. There's no support for that.
In looking at whether those assets are available to pay for her bills, we have to consider whether they're saleable, and that's what this subdivision is dealing with. In terms of life estates, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. It does discuss that.
In other places in the statute, so we read the statute as a whole, and in subdivision 1D, for example, the statute uses the word applicant. But in subdivision 4A, it doesn't use the word applicant. It uses the word individual. And given that we're trying to look at whether these assets are available to pay for bills, isn't it the more logical reading of the term individual there, even though we're looking at eligibility, to be whether the individual's life estates are saleable?
Your Honor, life estates generally are saleable. It's not that they're not saleable. They're deemed unavailable until sold if someone were to invoke subdivision 4A of 256B.056. If someone were to become eligible for MA and then they sold that life estate interest, it is saleable, then those assets would count. However, if somebody became...
Hasn't the Department of Human Services in a prior agency decision already determined that assets really don't have... life estate assets really don't have value until they're sold?
Are you referring to the Vate decision, Your Honor?
The Leroy Vate decision.
Your Honor, that was a wrongly decided case. That case is not precedential for this court. There's also a district court case, the one below, and then there's another one from 2013, I believe.
Larson? Are you talking about Larson?
Yes, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. Those aren't precedential on this court.
But let me ask you one thing. Mr. Ashar-Vajan, the argument has been made that the department is really continuing to force Minnesota families to litigate against a rule that is really unpromulgated. You know, there's been inconsistent interpretation of this, clearly, as you're acknowledging, and it hasn't gone through formal rulemaking, but, you know, the department is now apparently changing its position and, you know, taking this more aggressive position with respect to the families.
And, Your Honor, the commissioner's position is that the law says what it says, and this is what the commissioner's position is right now.
But it has not been formally promulgated, has it?
The authority that we have is the authority that we have, Your Honor. I don't believe so. Mm-hmm. But this court could issue an order deciding this. And I would, to that end, Your Honor, Ms. Schmalz did recently die, and that's a recent development. And I just do feel like I should say that that may raise some mootness issues in this case.
Well, I wanted to ask both parties if I mean, no one has said that, and I understand her death was over a month ago, April 30th, I believe. So we haven't heard anything from either party to suggest that either side regards it as moot.
Correct, Your Honor. There hasn't been a motion to dismiss or anything. This is a recent development, and while my client would like this issue decided by the court, my client also understands that mootness is a jurisdictional issue, and if the court does not feel that it has jurisdiction as a result of Ms. Schmalz's death, the department would be happy to provide additional briefing.
Are you taking a position?
So orders. Your Honor, at this time, I don't feel comfortable taking a position one way or the other. I don't want to suggest to the court that I am ready to debate the merits of mootness at this time, okay, given this recent development and the lack of an opportunity to brief it. And there's been no motion to dismiss by any party. I would say that the department still wants this issue decided. And I will save remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent. And if in your remarks, too, you could speak to the mootness question, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you. May I please the court, counsel? My name is Casey Swanson. I'm here with John Saunders from Anderson Larson Law Firm in Wilmer. We represent the respondent in this matter. Just starting off as a general matter, it's the respondent's understanding that the appellant is taking the position that Ms. Schmaltz's life estate interests are treated differently than Mr. Schmaltz's life estate interests. As an initial matter, I'd point out that 42 U.S.C. 1396R5C and 256B59 subdivision 5 indicate that the assets of both spouses are to be considered in this eligibility determination. I don't see any basis in the law, most notably, subdivision or statute 256B056-4A, which would suggest that this analysis of their assets is to be different in any way. Counsel for the appellant argues, well, this is just about the medical assistance applicant, and that's why individual means medical assistance applicant. But the whole statutory...
I don't dispute that the statute deals with eligibility, and so the focus naturally would be on the person applying.
Of course, but I think we have to...
Isn't that a logical reading of the statute?
I don't believe it is a logical reasoning of the statute, Your Honor, for the reasons being that we don't just look at the medical assistance applicant when we're determining eligibility. These prior statutes, which were just referenced and cited by the appellant, indicate that both the assets of the community spouse and the institutionalized spouse are considered in determining a spouse's eligibility. We don't just get rid of or create different rules for the medical assistance applicant in subdivision 4A. There's nothing in there that makes that distinction. I would cite, the court's already gone through it in detail, but just the plain language, not only does it say an individual is not required to make a good faith effort to sell, but then it goes on to say, or the owner of the life estate and the owner of the remainder sell the entire property. Again, the ownership language is not limited to the institutionalized spouse. Moreover, as the next sentence goes on to read, and as was mentioned by the court, the legislature specifically used language, institutionalized spouse or community spouse. So those terms were known to the legislature. I know in the appellant's reply brief, the appellant raised the issue that that might have been some sort of amendment in 2008. Looking at the amended language in 2008, if you go back, I think that's really a moot point because it was in 2008, within that same amendment, that the word individual was added. So at the same time that they employed the institutionalized spouse and community spouse language, they also employed the individual language, which I would submit was an intentional choice to include both the community spouse and the institutionalized spouse's life estates within that exception. And frankly, it makes sense because as the court recognized, as the legislature recognized, a life estate interests, there's really no market for them to be sold. The appellant...
just to clarify, if this life estate is not counted, just hypothetically, not with this particular couple, but just a hypothetical couple, if a life estate is of the community spouse is not counted, and that person, then the institutional spouse is deemed eligible, that life estate that the community spouse then has title to, if that is later sold after the institutionalized spouse is deemed eligible, the funds from the sale are not required to be used to support the institutionalized spouse. Is that correct?
Your question is if the funds of a subsequently sold life estate of the community spouse are sold. Frankly, Your Honor, I have not addressed that hypothetical. I don't think it's an issue before the court.
Well, I guess my point is, or if that life estate, for example, a farm, if the community spouse has a life estate in the farm and is able to rent that farm out, doesn't it defeat the purpose of the statute if the community spouse gets income from that life estate that's not being used to support the institutionalized spouse?
Well, I think you have to look at the spousal impoverishment federal statutes where there is differential treatment for income for the community spouse. We don't want to leave a community spouse without anything for income. So I think it's addressed within those impoverishment statutes, the differential treatment there. But as I understand the argument being made by the appellant today, the same exact property is unsaleable for the institutionalized spouse, but at the same time, an asset that needs to be counted for the community spouse. And I just don't think that makes any sense in light of the legislature's determination that there's really no market for these life estates, and individuals don't need to make that good faith effort to sell them. And more importantly, I understand that they're not precedential cases, but I think it is important to point out each of those decisions that have already been submitted to this court in the briefings that have addressed this exact issue. The Vate decision, that was not even too long ago. It was 2014, I believe. And the director of the appellate division from the commissioner's office believed that decision where it said life estates aren't treated any differently for community spouses and institutional spouses was the correct decision. Throughout this entire proceeding, I haven't seen a single decision cited by the appellant which would support the appellant's interpretation that subdivision 4A only refers to an institutionalized spouse and does not refer to a community spouse's life estate. I also think it's important to point out, and I'm sure the court has it before, but the order issued by Judge Cox, again, I think that I haven't heard a reconciliation of the conclusions of law contained within that order, and that's the order that the appellant is currently asking to be affirmed. If you look at conclusion of law 3, it says, secondly, life estates are accountable real property asset for medical assistance eligibility purposes. Then it goes on to say, subdivision 256B056, subdivision 4A provides that a life estate will not be counted for purposes of eligibility. Provision 6 goes on to say, finally, life estates are countable assets at the time of eligibility determinations. I don't know how that language can be reconciled. There's no language in there that would suggest that it's making a determination that subdivision 4A only applies to institutionalized spouses, to community spouses. For this reason, and I think as was properly determined by the district court, that's an error of law. It represented not only an error of law, but the decision then to deny the application of medical assistance was also arbitrary and capricious.
Counsel, going back to the statute, or the statutes 256B.059, which deals with the valuation, and then 256B.056, which deals with eligibility, why would the legislature include the life estates in the valuation and then exclude them in terms of eligibility? And
sure.
Why don't you go ahead and answer that, and then I have another follow-up question for you. Sorry.
Sure. One potential reason that they might have included the valuation is because I think you still have to go through the verification stage in subdivision 4A. For instance, in the hearing that was before the court, there was evidence and findings of fact presented that basically demonstrated that the owners of the life estate or the owners of the remainder interest didn't intend to purchase the life estate at that time, or that the owner of the life estate and the owner of the remainder interest were going to sell the entire property. So I think that's part of the verification there. If there is not that verification, then it would be included and you would have that valuation there. So I think that's probably one of the main reasons why it is included. But I think I don't think it's inconsistent at all for subdivision 4A to say that this subdivision applies only for determining eligibility for medical assistance and does not apply to the valuation, just in case they were to run into that issue. Also, if in terms of your hypothetical, if the commissioner determined that a subsequently sold life estate were to be included, they would have that value in there, or the value when the holder of the life estate were to die. Again, just in terms of the special treatment that's afforded to life estates, I think it's important to cite to subdivision 59 and subdivision 5 in there, where it talks about supplemental security income assets excluded under there do not count towards that asset as available asset limit. And as the appellant mentioned in their principal brief, the supplemental security income statute, which was 42 U.S.C. 1382B, talks about that there's disposition differences for certain property. And in particular, so long as reasonable efforts to sell certain property have been unsuccessful, the individual is not required to, or that property is not included. I think that tracks perfectly in line with subdivision 4A that we have in the Minnesota statute. And again, I believe the appellant tries to get around that by again saying that 1382B only applies to the institutionalized spouse, but clearly 1382B uses the same broad owner language in terms of the property where reasonable efforts to sell it have not been successful. So,
are you aware of any case law interpreting 1382B, the federal statute, and the word owner?
I recall some research not exactly on point with life estates. I think it might have been related more to annuities, but I can't recall off the top of my head any specific holdings related to that. But the respondent's position in terms of 1382B is simply that that ownership language is purposefully broad so as to reference any owner of property that's being analyzed there.
I know I've asked a lot of questions, and Judge Hallbrooks specifically wanted you to address the mootness question, so if you could address that
right
now, I'd
thank
appreciate
you.
It.
I believe part of the issue in terms of mootness might depend on if the appellant is seeking any sort of reimbursement of medical assistant costs that have already been paid for Ms. Schmaltz. My understanding is that subsequent to Judge Sleater's order at the end of last year, medical assistance expenses were paid for Ms. Schmaltz. So I'm not sure if the appellant has taken any position in regard to recovery or reimbursement of any of those expenses. If they are, I would certainly say that this issue is not moot. In any event, the respondent thinks it is important to get an answer on this issue. It is frustrating that this is a Renville County case. Vate was a Renville County case. It's the facts are pretty much indistinguishable. We have the decision from the commissioner that life estates of the community spouse and the institutionalized spouse are excluded in determining eligibility there. Then a couple of years later in the same county, we have the same facts, and now they're saying the community spouse's life estates aren't excluded from the eligibility determination. I'm not sure how we got to the point where there's now that change, but I think it needs to be addressed because, as I mentioned, it is frustrating for medical assistance applicants that are relying on these prior decisions and the plain language of these statutes.
For those, it does seem to be an issue that would reoccur.
Correct.
Yeah.
For those reasons, we would simply ask that Judge Sleater's order be affirmed and any denial of Ms. Schmaltz's medical assistance application be reversed and denied.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson.
Thank you.
Any rebuttal? Mr. Asharbajan?
Yes, Ms. Charter, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I did want to follow up on a few points that counsel did make. First, 256B.056, I'd just like to reiterate that last sentence, it would violate, if it didn't have the meaning that the commissioner argues it does, it would violate the canon against surplusage. The commissioner's interpretation is consistent with both 256B.059 and all relevant statutes here. Life estates are saleable. I did want to make that point. They're deemed unavailable until sold. If someone were to become eligible, life estates aren't counted for an MA applicant. They become eligible at any time if they sell it or they get proceeds from the property. Those costs would go ahead and be calculated into the responsibility to pay for that person's care. But once somebody becomes eligible for MALTC, the assets of the spouse, the community spouse, and the institutionalized spouse, they're treated differently. So if, let's say, somebody who had a lot of life estate interests that weren't counted for some reason, if the court were to accept the respondent's interpretation of the law, if those are subsequently sold, that money does not go to the MALTC spouse's cost of care. The public is on the hook for that. Again, the district court decisions and the administrative decisions that have decided this issue in the past are not binding on this court. I'm unaware of any binding authority that's decided this issue for this court. This is an issue of de novo statutory interpretation for this court today.
Why is it, though, that the commissioner took the completely opposite position prior?
That's a tough pill to swallow, Your Honor, and I don't have an answer for that, but that's wrong, and I do acknowledge that it's not maybe the greatest look, but it was a different position.
You're arguing that the statute is unambiguous. You're not arguing here that it's ambiguous, correct?
It's unambiguous. It was decided wrongly before. It's been decided wrongly in these administrative decisions. It's unambiguous. The court can decide this in a de novo review based on the plain language of the statutes, but without reading the statutes in isolation, 256B.059 matters. I think the court needs to start there and then end at 256B.056. The district court, the review in these types of cases, it's a review of the agency decision, not necessarily the district court decision, as counsel did note. But as far as like the actual legal conclusions made below, that's a de novo review for this court. The issue is whether or not Ms. Schmaltz was eligible as of April 2017 for medical assistance long-term care. The answer to that question is no, Your Honors. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel. Sorry about the passing of Mrs. Schmaltz. The matter has been submitted.